Meanwhile, Detroit, the city, is still struggling, and its mayor, Dave Bing, is looking for ways to revitalize the Motor City. His latest plan involves bringing police officers back to the city as residents. About half of Detroit's police force lives outside the city, and by law, they can't be forced to live in Detroit. NPR's Sonari Glinton reports on a plan to lure them back.
Here's the enticement. For $1,000 down, an officer gets a rehabbed house worth $40,000 to $80,000, and
the police officer would get to pick carpet, color, cabinets, and help design the rehab as it goes along.
Carla Henderson is with the city of Detroit. She says encouraging police officers to return will increase safety, pump up the tax base, and go a long way to solving other problems.
We have hundreds of homes that are sitting vacant, and we have a community that has said we would love to have the police move back into our neighborhood.
And they're not going to leave their homes to come back down to the city. I know that for a fact.
Michael Patton runs the police uniform store right across the street from police headquarters. Patton says the city has to try to get officers back.
But to convince someone to leave Farmington Hills to come back to the city of Detroit, it's going to be hard.
Detroit will offer 200 homes in the program at first. Carla Henderson says she hopes to expand the program to firefighters, teachers, first responders, and maybe one day, city officials. Sonari Glinton, NPR News, Detroit.
Every year since 1935, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Social Security into law, the program has taken in more money through payroll taxes than it paid out. That is, until last year. Social Security has now officially gone cash negative. To make matters worse, the country has been borrowing for decades from surplus Social Security revenues. As NPR's David Wellner reports, it's time to start paying that money back.
Over the years, Social Security has collected about $2.5 trillion more than it's paid out. It's used those extra funds to buy special bonds from the U.S. Treasury, building up what's come to be known as the Social Security Trust Fund. When George W. Bush first ran for president a little more than a decade ago, he proposed taking $1 trillion worth of bonds out of that fund to put into private investments. At a candidate debate with Al Gore in St. Louis, Bush dismissed concerns that his plan might weaken Social Security.
Now remember, Social Security revenue exceeds expenses up until 2015. People are going to get paid.
But Al Gore had a very different proposal.
Putting both Social Security and Medicare in an ironclad lockbox where the politicians can't touch them, to me, that kind of common sense is a family value. Hands off.
Neither the lockbox nor the private investments ever came to pass, nor did Bush's prediction that Social Security revenues would outstrip expenses until 2015. At a recent Senate Budget Committee hearing on the nation's economic outlook, Chairman Kent Conrad noted that there's been a sea change in Social Security's finances.
My staff informs me, under the new report,
Social Security has gone permanently cash negative now. Is that the case?
Yes, that's right.
The affirmative response came from Congressional Budget Office Director Doug Elmendorf, whose agency prepared the report. Conrad added that the time had finally come for the money Social Security's lent the federal government to be paid back.
How's it going to be paid back? It's going to be paid back by the other general expenditure of the federal government having to be reduced to make way for the payments that we're going to have to make on those bonds.
The purchase of the bonds came from the Social Security revenue. So you're just paying back something you owe.
That's Lawrence Lindsay, who was former President Bush's chief economic advisor. Lindsay readily acknowledges the money that must now be paid back to Social Security has all been spent.
That's a flaw in the design of the fiscal system. And I think it points up one of the reasons why you do not want to have the nation's retirement based simply on Social Security.
Republicans say the time's come to revise the Social Security program. Lamar Alexander is a member of the Senate GOP leadership team.
It's very significant that this year Social Security has more money going out than coming in. And it's very significant that in the next 10 years, Social Security will add $500 billion to the deficit. Social Security would be a good place to start when dealing with these mandatory entitlement programs that are 57% of our budget.
But some prominent Democrats are pushing back.
Social Security has not contributed one penny to the debt. And as I've said before, people should leave Social Security alone.
That's Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid drawing a line in the sand earlier this month.
I will do everything that I can in throwing my legislative body in front of any efforts to weaken Social Security.
Republicans, for their part, say Democrats should make the first move on Social Security. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is waiting for President Obama to make that move.
There will be no entitlement reform without presidential leadership. And to the extent that the president is willing to join with us and discuss how we deal with these long-term unfunded liabilities, I think virtually every Republican is ready to have that discussion.
McConnell's deference to the president is hardly surprising. It's not for nothing that Social Security is known as politics' third rail. Touching it can prove politically perilous. But with the program now operationally in the red, with a new wave of baby boomers retiring and living longer, and with revenues reduced even further by high unemployment and a payroll tax cut, there are few who think Social Security is not more vulnerable today than it's ever been. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. We're reporting this morning on one of the bitter ironies of the economy. It's a reminder that marriage is a union of finances as well as love.
During the worst of the recession, we heard that the divorce rate was dropping. Now it's rising as the economy comes back. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Divorce is expensive, so when the economy tanked, a lot of unhappy couples decided it just wasn't the time to split. Some held off when they couldn't sell their home. Federal figures suggest the divorce rate fell about 7% between 2006 and 2009, and divorce lawyers across the country saw business dry up. But that's changing.
I would say that over the last 6 months, the activity in our firm has probably picked up by 20-25%.
In fact, Washington, D.C. lawyer Sandy Ain is getting so many calls he can't handle them all. He sees several reasons for the uptick.
One is the credit markets are actually loosening up. Banks are starting to lend money again.
That means someone can borrow money to buy out a spouse, say to pay for one share of the house, or, as is common for business owners, to give a spouse his or her legal share in the family enterprise. The other big change? The stock market's nearly doubled from its darkest days. When retirement funds and savings accounts are fatter, people feel more secure striking out on separate lives. Finally, there is simply pent-up demand.
When a person is ready to have a divorce, they generally don't like it to take 2 or 3 or 4 years to get finished.
Linda Lee Viken heads the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers.
So I think there's a part of the population who just doesn't want to wait anymore.
Still, crude as it seems, the business cycle can play a crucial role in a divorce settlement. Some lawyers have been advising clients to put off separation during the down economy. Viken says whether now is the right time depends.
If a person receives a business, for example, and another person receives a house, the value of those two assets is extremely important in determining what else happens.
That's because the aim is often a 50-50 split of assets. So if, say, a man receives a business that's been hit hard during the recession and is valued low, he'll likely get to keep more of the couple's other assets. And that property settlement is final. No redoing it once the economy rebounds and that business or house is worth a lot more. Viken says there's something else to consider. It used to be that if your ex-spouse took over a joint credit card or mortgage, the bank or lender would take your name off the contract. But since the recession, no more.
Because they want to be assured that they have two people they can go after for these debts. So if the other person defaults on it, you may not even know that. And yet your credit's going to be affected, and eventually you're going to get that phone call about this huge debt that hasn't been paid.
Overall, divorce has been on the decline in recent years, and Brad Wilcox of the National Marriage Project says a lot of couples report the recession actually strengthened their union. Still, money woes are notoriously tough on marriages, and Wilcox says the recession has hit lower-income Americans hardest.
Clearly, my view is that as we move forward here, we're going to see the long arm of the recession kind of reaching out and grabbing working class and poor couples a lot more than college-educated and more affluent couples.
In a survey out this week, Wilcox finds those without a college degree are twice as likely to say they are thinking of divorce. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. President Obama's administration is about to set off a debate that involves billions of taxpayer dollars and also the health of the entire American housing market.
The debate is over the future of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Those two companies founded by the government have become major players in the mortgage market.
They also needed federal help during the financial crisis. Tomorrow, the administration is expected to present a menu of options on what it believes the government's role should be in housing finance. Our coverage begins with NPR's Tamara Keith.
The government took Fannie and Freddie into conservatorship at the height of the financial crisis. 2 years later, the bill to taxpayers is more than $130 billion and counting. And love 'em or hate 'em, Fannie and Freddie now play a larger role in the nation's housing finance system than ever. Guy Sakala is the publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance.
The government now is financing upwards of 90% of all the mortgages being made in this country,
with the bulk of that being done by Fannie and Freddie. Here's how it works. Banks issue the loans, then they sell them to Fannie and Freddie. The firms bundle those loans up into securities, stamp them with an implied government guarantee, and then sell them off to investors. They used to have competition, but these days, Sakala says the private sector is on the sidelines.
It's clearly much too large a government footprint in the mortgage market.
And that is one thing almost everyone agrees on. Michael Barr is a law professor at the University of Michigan who recently left the Treasury Department. He says for the near term, the Obama administration's plan will include a series of steps.
To begin to wind down Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and begin to draw in private sector capital and begin to set the stage for housing finance reform.
The idea would be to gradually limit Fannie and Freddie's size by reducing the number of loans they handle. That could be done by increasing the fees they charge and by lowering the conforming loan limit. In some high-cost areas, Fannie and Freddie can bankroll loans for up to $729,000. That limit would drop back to $625,000 this fall, unless Congress intervenes.
And that's a way of saying, well, for the largest mortgages, for jumbo mortgages, let's let the private sector take on that risk. Let's see how they perform. Let's try and draw that private capital back in.
And while these ideas would start to limit the government's footprint in the mortgage market, they aren't the kind of sweeping reforms that many are calling for. For that, Barr says the administration will lay out a menu of options, but it won't stake out a hardline position.
I don't think that the administration wants to poke the House Republicans in the eye with a plan that they'd fundamentally disagree with.
So instead, the administration appears poised to say, "The ball's in your court, guys."
Let's start a conversation with a set of options. Let's see what the Republicans come up with in the House, what the Democrats come up with in the Senate, and then hopefully come to a better agreement on longer-term reform goals.
At a House committee hearing yesterday, it was clear neither party had cemented its position on a path forward for Fannie and Freddie. Jarrett Seeberg is an analyst with MF Global who follows financial policy.
It's much harder to get something done in Washington than it is to prevent something from getting done. And, you know, our view is the most likely outcome is some version of the status quo. Fannie and Freddie may yet live to see another day, another year.
Seeberg says that limiting the government's role in housing finance will make mortgages more expensive for would-be homeowners, and that could hurt the already weak housing market. Guy Sakala from Inside Mortgage Finance says this will weigh heavily on policymakers.
And as long as the housing market is terribly weak, people are going to be reluctant to do major wholesale changes to the mortgage market, or they'll say we'll do them in 2 or 3 years when they hope the housing market gets better.
Or maybe 5 or 7 years, he says. What to do about Fannie and Freddie remains the last big unresolved issue from the housing bubble and the financial crisis that followed. And it may stay that way for a while. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.